Right. That being said, we'll get started. So this week, the Torah portion is Parshat Vayera, not to be confused with the second portion in the book of Shemot, the book of Exodus, Va'era. They sound similar, but they are not the same. Vayera is the name of this week's Parsha. And it starts with the most, perhaps, most famous story regarding Abraham and Sarah. Avram and Sarah, they are known for their hospitality. And the Torah takes us and tells us that at the end of last week's Torah portion, Avraham had shown his dedication and his commitment to God by performing circumcision at a very advanced age, right? I don't see too many people lining up to walk in Abraham's path at this point, but suffice it to say, that was pretty impressive. So he's recuperating from his major surgery, and the parsha begins with God coming to pay him a visit. Not surprisingly, this is one of the sources that the Talmud uses of why we, emulating God, go to visit the sick. This is a story of where God came to visit Abraham, who was ill. He was recuperating from his surgery. We, again, wanting to emulate God, we follow in his footsteps and to go ahead and to visit the sick. But here's what's amazing. God is having a conversation with Abraham. And in fact, the Torah does not record what they talked about. It's just, and God appeared to him in the plains of Mamre while he was sitting at the entrance of the tent in the heat of the day. He lifted his eyes and he saw, behold, three men were standing over him. He perceived, so he ran toward them from the entrance of the tent and bowed toward the ground. And he said, "My Lord, if I find favor in your eyes, please pass not away from your servant." This is the famous story of the three quote unquote angels that come to visit. They're traveling, or they appear as travelers before Abraham, and Abraham wants to invite them in to perform his hospitality that he is famous for. Before we get too much into it, just ask a simple question. For whose benefit is it to provide hospitality? Who would one think that the beneficiary, right? Using the example, right? I play the rabbi on TV, so I'll just continue with that theme. I'm going to provide hospitality for somebody. Somebody's in need. I bring them into my home pre or post COVID, and everything is great. I provide them a meal like that. Who is the beneficiary?
You are.
Me? Or the person who I took in?
You are.
You.
Really? What? Come on, Elian, come to my defense here. Who is the
It's
beneficiary?
the person who you're helping.
Of course. Like, what's the question? Everybody's trying to be a Talmudic scholar. Really? It's like this. Let's be honest. Who is the beneficiary here?
You.
Who I took into my house?
The other person.
The other person, of course. Everyone's trying to
You.
be a chacham here, you know. Oh, I'm gonna use reverse psychology on the rabbi. He's asking a trick question. Call a spade a spade. There's no question on this one. The beneficiary is the person who I helped. It becomes a little problematic because the following: Avraham is distressed that he has no visitors. He has no guests. That's why the Torah tells us that he was sitting at the entrance of his tent despite it being in the heat of the day. I don't know about you guys, but after surgery or even after a simple cold, I'm not up to waiting at my door, can't wait, or sitting there next to my phone, can't wait for the next student or the next parent to call me with some issue or need that they have. It's not at the, I'm being honest, I shouldn't really have this recorded publicly, but it's not exactly, I would like to stay in my bed. I'd like to take the afternoon off. You know, in the old days, we say take the phone off the hook, right? And just don't bother me. But that's not Abraham. Abraham, in the heat of the day, Charles, you're cold now. Imagine it was 50 degrees. Or Arlene, you're schmaltzing over there, right? You imagine it's 90 degrees. Avraham is going to the entrance of his tent looking for visitors. It's exceptionally hot. So what does God do? He sends them. He sends him three angels to feed. Can I ask you a dumb question? It might rank up there as one of the dumbest. If God wants to give Abraham the opportunity to provide hospitality, right? That's what the scenario is. Why would he send him angels who don't eat? Why not cool down the day and get the regular, normal travelers who would be passing by anyway? You're going like this. You know, you're reaching over your head to scratch this ear. It doesn't make sense. If the whole objective, is to provide Abraham the opportunity for hospitality that he so much wants, then send him real people. Why send him disguised angels who aren't going to be eating anything anyway? That's not real hospitality. Why? Seems a little strange. So to answer this,
we're going to... for him.
What?
That other travelers couldn't give him.
Why not? God can make it happen that he cools down and travelers will come. That's why he's there in the first place. Why did he set up tent here? He pitched his tent in this area because there are travelers. I'll show you that at the end. You'll see. Okay? But we're going to go on a detour. We're going to talk about the famous biblical character, Ruth. Heard of her? Great. Anyone going like this? Mm-hmm. No, we're all good. Okay. We heard of Ruth. Fabulous. I'm going to read you just a quick, we know the basic storyline. Ruth marries into the family of a man named Elimelech and his wife. His wife's name is Naomi. The two of them have a few sons. One of the sons marries this girl, Ruth. She's not Jewish. So the story goes, there's a famine in Israel. They travel out. Elimelech doesn't want to have to give. It's another talk we can save for another time, how Elimelech tries to avoid and abrogate responsibility to help a community. He leaves. He doesn't want. Elimelech has plenty of money. He's well-to-do, but he's like, I don't want to be bothered by people knocking on my door every day. I'm leaving. So he picks up from Beit Lechem and he travels out of the country with his family. Tragedy strikes. Both of his sons die. And ultimately he dies as well. So picture the scene now. You have two women, mother-in-law and daughter-in-law, two daughters-in-law, and they're living in another country. They really have to fend for themselves. And Naomi basically says, listen, I have no more sons. Why don't the two of you just go back home? You, each of you, go back to your parents' place, go back to your old kingdom, your old ways. And famously, Orpah, the other daughter-in-law, says, okay. So she leaves. Okay, end of that story. But Ruth has a different objective. She says, no, Naomi, I have become close to you and I have accepted and I have learned about your God, about your religion. Where you go, I go. Where you stay, I stay. I'm on board. And Naomi tries to convince her, no, no, no. But Ruth wants no part of it. So these two ladies, these two women go back to the land of Israel and they don't have a penny to their name. So they have to go glean in other people's fields. Again, the Torah to the rescue. There is a mitzvah in the Torah to provide for the poor. You leave the corners of your field. If you're harvesting and you drop a few bundles, you have to leave them for the poor. There's a whole section of Torah law that's there to help the poor. It really is a very wonderfully organized welfare state, one that actually works. But be that as it may. So what happens? Ruth goes out to glean in a man by the name of Boaz in his field. Okay. All the details of the story are not relevant for right now, but I want to read you a section, just three sentences from the book of Ruth that will shed, I think, tremendous light on our question. Here's what it says. So she gleaned in the field until evening. She beat out what she had gleaned. It came to about an ephah of barley, not a large measurement. Enough that you can subsist and you can survive on. She carried it and came to the city. Her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned, and she took out and gave her what she had left over after eating her fill. So the two of them, Naomi and Ruth, they share the little that that Ruth had gleaned. Where did you glean today? Her mother-in-law asked her. Naomi asks Ruth, where did you go today to get this? Where did you work? May the one that took such generous notice of you be blessed. Ruth says, so she told her mother-in-law whom she had worked by and said, listen carefully, the name of the man by whom I work today is Boaz. Okay? Sounds like a pretty straightforward. I read you the translation. It's a fine if you want to get the general gist. But those of you who've attended my class in the past know that you have to read the original. You got to see it in Hebrew because it is not a straight translation. The last sentence where she said the name of the man, literally, I'll read it. Vatomer, and she said, Shem Ha'ish, the name of the man, Asher Asiti Imo Hayom, that I did with him today, Boaz. His name was Boaz. The grammar is almost backwards. You would expect it to say, the name of the man who did for me today was Boaz. But that's not what it says. The Megillah makes the point of saying that Ruth's words were, the man who I did something for, his name was Boaz. And never, never missing a beat, our sages pick up on that. And they point out very, very beautifully. More than what the host does for the poor person does for the host. More than what the host provides to the poor person, the real beneficiary is the host. Now, let's try to understand that. That's a nice, warm, fuzzy feeling you get. Oh, that's such a beautiful sentiment. Oh. But let's try to understand. Logically, it makes no sense. How are you the beneficiary? You gave everything. So let's dig a little deeper. Let's dig a little bit deeper. If you want, at towards the end of the Torah, where the Torah actually talks about providing, another place in the Torah where it talks about providing for the poor. It reads as follows. 15:7 here. If there shall be a destitute person among you, any of your brethren in any of your cities in your land that Hashem your God gives you, you shall not harden your heart or close your hand against your destitute brother. Rather, you shall open your hand. Remember palm, right? You shall open your hand to him. You shall lend him his requirement, whatever is lacking to him. Why? Because lest there be a lawless thought in your heart saying, oh, the seventh year approaches, the remission year. If I give him a loan, it's going to get canceled when the sabbatical year comes. I'm not so keen on giving out my money so quickly. No, you will look malevolently upon your destitute brother and refuse to give him, then he may appeal against you to Hashem and it will be a sin upon you. Rather, this is the punchline, you shall surely give him and let your heart not feel bad when you give him. For in return for this matter, Hashem your God will bless you in all your deeds and in your every undertaking. If you help your brother, if you help your sister, you help somebody who needs your help, what do you get in return? All the blessings that God has to bestow. You gave $100. Woohoo! Great job. You know how much you get back? Thousands. Who's the real beneficiary of giving kindness? It's not the one who received it. It's the one who gave it. They are the ultimate beneficiaries. In the premier chapter of Hachnasat Archim, of taking in guests, providing for those who need, travelers, whatever the case may be, we are told about people who did not need to eat. Angels. Why? Because the lesson is, the host should remember, he is the one who needs the mitzvah, not the one who's, quote, the beneficiary. The real person who benefits most from this is the giver, not the taker. Yes, the taker definitely receives something. But in the end, the one who receives the most out of it is the giver. To me, the phrase that Midrash uses, more than what the host provides for the poor provides to the host, is such a true concept. God blesses us and gives us, not just in the world to come, of course, but the blessing is that even in this world, we are given back more than what we gave. In fact, there's an expression that's used. We know that giving a tithe, right? We know what tithing, giving, where's the word tithe come from? We're supposed to give a tenth, one tenth of what we earn, we're supposed to be giving away. That's the general rule. In an agricultural society, it was 10% of the produce. In our society, it's 10% of your income. That's what it should be. I will tell you, and I'll maybe refer this back when we get to the end of our class, but one of the smartest and nicest piece of advice we ever got, my wife and I think, Liz, I shared this with our group, Sandy and Alan, I think I told you this. One of the nicest, smartest piece of advice we ever got when we first got married was that we should open two checking accounts. No, not a his and hers. No. That's not great marital advice. Great marital advice is where you open up a second checking account. One is for your operating needs and the other is your charity fund. Every single time we get a paycheck, we take off a percentage and we transfer it to our charity fund. This way, whenever there's a need, a poor person comes, I hear about a situation, the synagogue is having a fund drive, no problem. Pull out my charity checkbook, write it, stuck a check. I feel no pain whatsoever. I don't have to sit and say, oh, how am I going to meet my monthly expense? That's the wrong account. I'm looking in the wrong place. If the charity checkbook has money, I have no problem. I can write a check. If it doesn't, that means I gave out my allotment. All right, I'll push it off for a couple of weeks till my next paycheck, and then I'll deal with it. But I don't feel the pain and the sting and wringing of my hands. Should I or shouldn't? No. I take off my percentage and we put it in our checking account, the charity one. One of the smartest pieces of advice we ever got. We'll come back to that story.
Yourself first.
Huh? Okay. So therefore, again, in the premier chapter where it teaches us all of these laws about what it means to invite guests and to have to extend ourselves to others, we specifically, that God sends people who don't need it because ultimately they're not the real beneficiaries, the host is. It would also explain why when Abraham turns to his family, to Sarah, and he offers these guests and he says, I'll get you bread to eat and all. The term that the Torah uses is ve'ekha pat lechem. It's translated in, I will bring to you loaf of bread. But that's not the literal translation. Ve'ekha means an I will take. Okay, colloquially you can say, I will take from my stash so that I can give you. But that's a weird way to say it. The answer, based on what we're saying tonight, is that Avraham ultimately receives. He's the one who is taking by giving. This concept of taking off a tenth, ma'aser, the Torah uses a double expression. When it talks about taking a tenth, tithing, it says aser te'aser, you shall surely tithe. It uses a double expression, almost for emphasis. The Torah is putting the emphasis on a very important syllable. The emphasis being, make sure you give a tenth, says it with conviction. But the Talmud delves deeper and says, still doesn't explain why the term, aser ta'aser, just say, te'aser, you shall tithe. That's pretty strong. That's how most of the language in the Torah is. To do something, I tell you, do it. I don't use a, you shall surely, that's a little bit more of an exception than the rule. So the Talmud delves deeper and says, look at the word carefully. The word aser te'aser, these two words, aser te'aser, the root of the word is aser, ayin shin resh, or ayin sin resh. That's what the word means. It means from the word eser. What's eser? What's eser?
Ten.
Ten. The number 10 in Hebrew is eser or asara, right? Like if you know the highlight of the prayer service, the Amidah is called the Shmona Esrei. Shmona is eight. Eser, Esrei is 10. 8 and 10, 18. There's 18 blessings. That's where the word comes from. Okay. So aser says the Talmud, but the letter sin, the way we're pronouncing it with an S sound, if you know Hebrew, and those of you who've taken my Hebrew reading course, you should know this, right? The only difference between the S sound and the SH sound is where you put the dot. It's a shin or a sin, right? Depends where the dot is. In the Torah, there are no dots, right? That's why we work so hard for the Bar and Bat Mitzvah kids to read from the Torah without any vowels. It's like, what? How do you read this stuff? Right. So we practice it. Yes.
Why does that count as a vowel?
Because you're thinking letters. In Hebrew grammar, letters are letters and vowels are symbols.
So even though it's the shin to the sin, that's considered a vowel sound?
Well, it's
the dot.
The dot. The dot is a symbol as to whether you pronounce it as an S or an SH.
So it's not, in addition to there not being vowels in the Torah, there's just no symbols in the Torah.
Well, those are the symbols. Symbols are the same as vowels.
Yes.
For me to pronounce my name, Tzvi, right? So how do you know that it's, well, it's not a great example because there really isn't too many options how to pronounce that. Let's think of another one. Leah, right? Maybe it's Lua. Mm-hmm. From the letters itself, you have no idea what the correct pronunciation is. Mm. Right? So we base it on the vowels. The vowels are those symbols, how to pronounce it as Le-ah instead of Lo-ah, Lu-ah, Li-ah.
But the dot that changes a shin and a...
All dots. That's called a vowel in this regard.
Okay.
I'm using the terminology. Okay.
Got it. Okay.
So technically, when you look at the letter in the Torah itself, you have no idea whether you pronounce it as a shin or a sin. There's no dots. So the Talmud, always delving deeper, says, yes, the correct pronunciation is with as a sin, an S, aser, you shall take a tenth. But on a deeper level, maybe the verse is telling us that if you do part A, God will do part B, meaning... You do aser, you take off a tenth, then te'asher. Ooh, asher, ayin shin resh, with that dot, you know what the word asher means? Rich and wealthy. And asher is a philanthropist, a wealthy person. The Talmud says God makes a deal with you. If you do aser, you tithe, I'll do te'asher. I'll make you wealthy. It's such an illogical concept in our world. We think that the more I give, the less I have. Sorry. Surprise! Happy birthday! It doesn't work that way. It's just the opposite. From a biblical perspective, if you give, you gain. You gain more. I cannot even begin to tell you how many times in my life I have seen this come true. In my own life and in the lives of many of my donors who have shared with me. There was many a time of where I would approach somebody and the person said, it's tough right now, but I'm going to push through it. And you guys are, I'm going to give you a little extra. And he told me time and time again, the next day, within a week, a certain stock that he had surprisingly went up. And the amount he got was the amount he had promised. It happens again and again and again. God makes you a deal. You do part A, aser, you give. Take off and give to others, I'll repay you with interest. Robin.
So quick question. When you're saying that, are you talking always about monetary repayment or can it be repayment, you know, spiritual?
So when it comes to giving money, the repayment is also money. But this concept of taking of yourself, tithing, is not limited to your money. The great There was a great sage from the previous generation. He passed away in the 80s, 1980s. His name was Rav Moshe Feinstein. I've quoted him before. A tremendous, tremendous leader for the Jewish people here in America. He was once asked the question, does this rule of taking a tenth, does that apply to one's time as well? We're all being pressed, you know, do I have to donate my time to help the synagogue, to help the organization? At what point? And his answer was yes. Yes, you should be devoting, call it approximately 10% of your time to help others, even if it's not financial. It's a totally separate accounting. But that's what this story is telling us. The real recipient of the goodness of the hospitality is the host. And that's why Abraham says, I will take the bread. Of course, he's giving it, but the concept, he will be repaid. That's the first lesson about what it means to have hospitality. You're the beneficiary. But let's take a step back. Give me one second. Let me just quickly grab a drink. Sorry.
You would
sit down a little better. Sorry about that.
Bourbon.
But let's go a little further. Let's go back to the first five sentences of this parsha. Let's read it again. You're all laughing. You have a good at my expense. You're all laughing. That's fine. Go ahead.
No,
that's fine. That's fine. You can all burn.
Somebody said you were drinking bourbon.
Why do you say that? That was the first thing I grabbed.
Oh, okay. See, that's the winter said that, right? Okay. I didn't say that.
That would be Alan.
It's water.
Winter said
it. Get excited.
Okay. Gotcha.
Anyway, listen to these first five sentences. Pretend you never heard this story before. Pretend. Okay? You don't know who we're talking about. It's just the first time. And I'm reading you the first five sentences. Hashem appeared to him in the plains of Mamre while he was sitting at the entrance of the tent in the heat of the day. He lifted his eyes and saw, behold, three men were standing over him. He perceived, so he ran toward them from the entrance of the tent and bowed toward the ground. And he said, my Lord, if I find favor in your eyes, please pass not away from your servant. Let some water be brought and wash your feet and recline beneath the tree. I will fetch a morsel of bread that you may sustain yourselves. Then go on, inasmuch as you have passed your servant's way. And they said, do so just as you have said. Who are we talking about?
Angels.
We have not mentioned Abraham's name once.
Once. Nope.
How weird is this? Who wrote this book? Okay, let's not go there. Seriously, it's so strange. We consist, it's anonymous. The first five verses have no mention of the main character in the story. But wait, let's add one more twist. Verse number six says, so Abraham hastened to the tent to Sarah and said, hurry, three saws of meal, fine flour, knead, make cakes. And Abraham ran to the cattle. Okay, now we got Abraham, Sarah. Next verse, he's going to get his son involved. Okay, now we got names. But for the first five sentences, you haven't even introduced me to the character? Even Robert Ludlum didn't write like this. You know, I'm saying you got to introduce a character. One of the most beautiful lessons I heard from a teacher in Ner Israel, the yeshiva that I went to here in Baltimore. The Torah is teaching us not just the importance of hospitality, but how to do it right. You know, guests, if you've ever had guests in your home, it's a difficult balance. You want to be able to serve them, but you don't want, the guests shouldn't be made to feel that the host is personally, you know, is going out of their way to serve him. You want them to feel comfortable, almost as if the host is just somewhere in the background. It's not about, oh, look what I can provide for you and look what I'm doing. No guest wants to see their host waiting on them hand and feet. As much as it looks great and they're honored, they're not. If you've ever been the recipient of that, it's so uncomfortable. You don't want them to extend themselves so far. You'd almost wish that you'd have a vending machine that they gave you the quarters for. You'd get what you need, and then you can sit down and talk to them like a mensch. That's what, come on, tell me I'm lying. We all feel this way. You don't want, as a host, or as a guest, I should say, you don't want the host to be, that's not real hospitality. You want to be, he doesn't say Abraham did this and Abraham did that. Imagine if the head of the yeshiva came and said, oh, I'd be happy, Tzvi, let me get you this and let me get you. I'd feel disgusting. I'd feel terrible. The dean of the yeshiva is serving me. I can't even eat. No. That's not how you do hospitality. The real way to do it is you, the host, almost be anonymous. Yeah, you do what you have to do to provide, but do it in a way that the guest doesn't feel that it's a burden or that you're so extended. He feels awkward that way. Be in the background. Look at the sensitivity that the Torah is teaching us. It's not just the Torah is telling us, oh, hospitality is so important. Look at this, God. God is talking to Abraham and Abraham says, God, just hold that thought. I got to go take care of somebody, which is what in fact happens here. Abraham tells God, hey, you know what? Go catch a show or something. I'll be back and I got to take care of these people. How? What? You're talking to God. You can't get a better audience. But yeah, the Talmud says from here, you learn how great the mitzvah of hospitality is. To do something for another human being that even God has put on ice while you deal with this. Yeah. But the way to do it is to do it quietly, anonymously. Until what point? Until verse 6, where it starts telling us Avraham turns to his family, to his wife, to his child. He only has one at this point, right? Now he says something different. You know what he says? He turns to his family and teaches them a second lesson. When he's encouraging them to get involved, he emphasizes that even me, the great Avraham, the one who God was speaking to just a few minutes ago, even me, I'm running enthusiastically to go help somebody. Don't ever say, my child, don't ever say, my student, oh, it's below my dignity. I'll let the servant do it. I'll let someone else do it. In Yiddish, we say, pasnisht. It's below my dignity. That's not a problem. Don't ever say that. Avraham says, I'm doing it. I'm 99 flipping years old. I just had surgery. I'm talking to God. Yeah, I'm doing it. What a great setting of an example for his family. It's critical. We as parents or grandparents, we know how important it is to set an example. It has to be. We all know it. Growing up, we heard it, but we know it not to be true. Do as I say, not as I do. Terrible. Horrible. That's not the way we do it. It's do as I do. And if you're not sure, do it. Don't do as I say. Because then what you're going to do is you're going to produce children who are going to do the exact same thing to their children. Just do as I say. I'm going to do something else. That's not parenting. Do it right. Avraham says, I'm going myself. I'm going to get the cattle. I'm going to prepare the meal. Yeah. When he's talking about the guests, when he's interacting with the guest, he's anonymous. He's just Joe Schmo, just a regular guy. But when he's talking to his family, he's saying, even somebody of my stature, yeah, it's not below my dignity. It shouldn't be below yours either. This is how we teach. This is how we parent. This is how we teach. There's a great expression that's when it's dealing with children, and it says, tell me I forget. Show me I remember. Involve me I understand. That's an ancient Chinese proverb. Confucius, probably. I don't know. Somebody. Okay? So that's point number two, the importance of it, you're the recipient, and how to do it. But let's add another piece to this. Two more pieces. Most people, I think, fall into the following category. I'm happy to help. I'm happy to do chesed and provide a kindness. When I become aware of somebody's need, I'm open to it. Yeah. The Torah here teaches us, if you look it up, it's actually not in this section. If you look later on in the book of the prophets, in the book of Micah, Micah uses a term. What God tells him is that what we have to strive to do is asot mishpat ve'ahavat chesed, that we are to do justice and love kindness. Again, my ninth grade English teacher would never have let that fly. Never. She would have said to me, Zvi, it's a beautiful sentiment, but grammatically incorrect. Why don't you just say, do justice and kindness, or love justice and kindness? Why are you using two different verbs? Do justice, love kindness. It seems repetitive and superfluous. Not only that, it's extra. Right? Why does the prophet use this terminology? Two different terms. So the great sage, the Chafetz Chaim, who passed away in 1933, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, taught us this lesson. He said, the Torah is teaching us this profound lesson. It's not enough to just do kindness. That's not enough. You know, most of us would do a kindness when we're asked, when the need arises, or more likely when we have no way out. When we have no other excuses, we're like, fine, if you can't find somebody else, call me back. How many times have you heard that? Right? How many times have you said that? Right. That's not really kindness. That is some level. The Chafetz Chaim says, no. This verse is telling us there's due justice. There's no wiggle room. Justice is something you either do or don't do. Therefore, do it. Do the right thing. But when it comes to kindness, it's more than just do it. You have to do it to the extent of where you love doing it, it becomes second nature. You seek the opportunities, not wait for it to come. If you love brisket, Sid, if you love it, you don't wait for the holiday for brisket. You turn to Michelle and you say, honey, sweetie, I'm really in the mood for brisket. You're not going to wait for the next holiday because you love brisket. Tell me I'm wrong.
He loves brisket.
He loves brisket and he's not waiting till Pesach to get it. He wants his brisket. Fine. If you love chesed, you love kindness, that's what we're really that's what we're encouraged to do. Just to say do kindness, so that means it's a checkbox. An opportunity arises and I have no, okay, fine, I'll do it.
Oh my.
That's not what we're being asked to do. We're asked to a point of ahavas chesed. Love it to the extent of where you pursue, perhaps even create those opportunities. That's what we have. Therefore, Avraham, although recovering from surgery, 99 years old, he had plenty of servants to check for travelers in the middle of talking to God. But that's not how it works. If you love chesed, you love helping people, it's so your nature now to do it, you don't wait for the opportunity, you create them. And finally, one other observation. Some of us, in some ways legitimately, have a little barrier to overcome when it comes to extending ourselves. And I was referencing it before when I talked about creating the second checking account for your charity. I don't know about you, but it is, for me, it is a struggle. I don't like necessarily, I do look at my bottom line. I do look at my checking account and say, I thought it was a little higher. I don't know. Maybe it's just me, but right. So you're, and it's hard. I have to go, or I get another phone call to go help somebody. You know what? I did enough this week. It's Wednesday. I probably have amassed a few chesed points. Call my brother. Right. My mother will call and say, no, Ma, call Avi today. Call Avi. No. We sometimes say, or we face the challenge of overcoming that barrier of, I don't have the money, I don't have the time, I don't have the ability. And all we see is, I don't have, I don't have, I don't have. Well, let me teach you one more aspect that I think can help us. This concept of taking a tenth is not limited to agriculture. It's not limited to our income. The Torah actually teaches us that it applies even if we have our flock. If we're shepherds, every tenth sheep I should be giving as an offering to the temple. The Kohen will get a piece of it. But that's, you know, every tenth one, all newborn animals. The way, the procedure, how it's done is fascinating. The farmer, the shepherd rather, is obligated to take his entire herd and have them walk through a narrow passageway enough for one to go through single file. And they will all go through, and he counts them. One, two, he'll be asleep. I don't know about you, but I count sheep. I'm usually asleep by the time I get to six or seven. But hopefully he's standing and he had a good coffee. He goes one, two, three. Every tenth one that they come through, he marks with a certain red dye, paint, whatever marker. And then all the tens are taken as offerings and given as a gift. The question that the commentators ask is, why go through this whole process? The farmer knows how many new sheep he has that were born this year. Let him take his total, divide it by 10, and give it. I mean, I know that's, in today's day, that's called higher order math, but most of us can do it. Why do you have to have this process of single file, one, one, two, three, four? You know what? It's because most of us would likely say, if we did it the other way of where, oh, so I had 1,000 sheep, I have to give 100? Are you kidding me? That's like another whole herd. We will immediately go into defensive mode and come up with all the excuses why not. So you know what the Torah says? I'll help you. I'm going to teach you how to appreciate what you have. Count them. Number one, oh, that's mine. Number two, that's mine. Three, that's mine. Four, that's mine. Five, six, seven, even eight. Number nine, mine, mine, mine. Oh, number 10, okay, that's for God. One, mine. Two, mine. Three, mine. Wow, what a different, it's the same number in the end, but you learn to appreciate what you have and how blessed we are. What a great idea. Take a good look at everything he has, how truly blessed he is. Then it's not so hard to give it away. All right, so a 10th. Yeah, 1,000. I got to give 100? Don't do it that way. Look how many you get to keep. These are the 4 points about holy hospitality. This is how we can become this good people who understand it's not just checkbox. I did my job. I did my act of chesed. Ooh, I was so good job, T. That's not how it works. Number one, remember, you, the giver, are the number one recipient. You are the beneficiary more than the one who's receiving. Number two, do it smartly. Do it in a way that the guest doesn't feel embarrassed or awkward. Make yourself as anonymous as Abraham was. But when you talk to your family, say, yeah, I did it myself. You should learn to do this too. And number three, it's not just do goodness. You do justice, but love kindness. Love it. Let it become a part of you. Second nature. And lastly, how to overcome. Take a step back and look at how much we are blessed with, how much we do have. As little as we think we have so much. And yeah, we are to give of ourselves, our time, our energy, our finances, whatever it is God has blessed us with. Because in the end, we become better people and we're blessed even more to continue doing what we've done. These are the four lessons I want you to walk out with just 6 verses of the parsha this week. At this rate, we'll probably finish the entire parsha in about 75 years. So as long as you stick around, we'll continue, God willing, doing this. But however long it takes, it takes. Any questions or comments or rebuttal?
This was great for the month of November. for Thanksgiving, it was very
good.
Target.
Good. I still have three more lessons before Thanksgiving.
I know. So you're good.
I should have saved this. Maybe I can ask God to switch the, you know, maybe we can do this in 2 weeks.
Maybe for Virginia. Seriously.
We just did it for Virginia.
Well,
you're here. The winters are here. No. It's always new material. Nice try. Thanks, though. I'm all for recycling, but not with the same people. John.
In the beginning, you said, who is the beneficiary?
In the beginning, God created heaven and earth.
In the beginning of this Parsha, yes. You said, who is the beneficiary? And the answer was the host. Could you also say that all of his family and all of his followers are also beneficiaries, and all the future generations are beneficiaries, because here they saw that Abraham led by example, that Abraham is not a guy who just talks the talk, but he walks the talk.
He walks, yeah.
So they benefit from learning this lesson.
Absolutely.
Their next generation and continue on and on.
Correct. And I know you've heard me say this before. What does the word Torah mean? Torah does not mean Bible. That is not the translation. The word Torah is related to the word Mora. A Mora is a teacher. This is a book of instruction. If the Torah records this story, it's not just what people say for posterity. No, this is not for posterity. This is for a life example. This is a life lesson that we all need to learn. And yes, we in 2020 are the beneficiaries of Avraham's hospitality. Yeah, absolutely. You are 100% correct.
Also, I read the Maimonides' 10 levels of charity, and I kind of understood it, but after today's lesson, I think it makes it even clearer how he made those different levels.
Right. The top level, for those who are interested, the Maimonides lists the best ways, methods of helping somebody and giving charity. The top level, if I remember correctly, John, correct me if I'm wrong, is helping them get a job, helping them sustain themselves, not as a handout. That's the least awkward way, because you're helping them earn it themselves instead of having to give them something. If that's not feasible, so then at a lower level, it's, I don't know who I'm giving it to, and the recipient doesn't know who it came from. Saving their human dignity. They don't feel embarrassed. And he goes through a whole list of levels. But 100%, this is the concept of where in the forefront of our mind, when we're doing the right thing, there's a way to do it also. Not just a checkbox, I did it, but how can I do it in the best possible way that is most beneficial for everybody?
It's the teach a man to fish thing.
Correct. That's correct. For those who like fish. All right, folks. Have a wonderful evening. If I don't speak to you beforehand, have a great Shabbos, and we'll see you back here next week, Tuesday and Wednesday.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a good evening.